Hi, everybody. My name is Larry. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the secretary and whoever has me out here again to be with you folks. And I think I've been talking on Mark's birthday for about 25 years. And I'm pretty privileged to be able to do that. One of the years we were doing this, he had me over in Lancaster, and the hotel was like the Beehive Hotel or something like that, you know, and beautiful place. And usually when you go into a hotel and, you know, over there where the lamp is, you open up the drawer, and there's usually a Gideon's Bible or some kind of Bible. Well, that didn't happen that night. I opened up the drawer, and there was a can of Skol and a stick and some electrical tape. And I thought, man, I'm in the honeymoon suite, you know. What a great hotel. You got it going on here, man. And anyway, I'm always pleased to be here near, and I want to thank Alan for driving out here and all that stuff. And if you're new, I want to welcome you and to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm no big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just a regular member, coffee maker, active member of my own home group, which is a big book group in Bellflower, California. And that's all I need to tell you about me. Is that that's what saved my life, you know. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for 41 years. You need your court card signed? Oh, no.
I got to go.
Jesus, you couldn't do it on the 10-minute speaker, huh? No. Wait till the old man gets up there, you know what I mean? Nice. Thank you, sir.
There you go.
Thank you very much. I tell you, here's a new commitment, is somebody should change and wash this sponge, because it smells like old soup. That would be a good commitment, right? Or, you know, put a new one on here. It's kind of sour over here, man. Not over here, over here. Right? You guys are all right. But anyway, if you're new, my sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for 41 years and not amount to a damn thing. So I don't know where you think you're going in AA, but the highest I've ever gotten is sober, basic human being, active member of my own home group. And that's as high as I need to get, you know. I'm surrounded by people who've gotten higher than that. And you know what floats them out? The good life. The good life. Me and you know exactly what to do when the heat's on. We know exactly what to do. But man, when you start getting a little bedroom privilege back and a little steady job and you got a little dog to walk now and, you know, you got a nice 62 Chevy to drive around, you know, and these become more, and little by little, you start edging Alcoholics Anonymous. Hey, I got to take care of the kid. I got to, you know, like, you know, she's got to play tonight, man. I can't go. I tell you, man, there is one thing that I've learned not to mess with. And that is my routine. Get yourself a routine. Start your day off on your knees and doing your reading and give yourself to this simple program and make your phone calls and have a handful of meetings that you go to. I mean, these are the no matter what meetings. You know what I mean? And get you about three or four of those things, man. And stick to that routine, because you'll find that when anything goes sour in your life, you lose a life, you lose a loved one, you get one back. I mean, you know. You don't need to alter your routine. And that becomes the steadiest thing you got, man. And that's how I learned to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, is I stuck to my routine. I didn't have to change my calendar around when anything happened. You know what I mean? And that's been my saving grace. That's been my saving grace. And, you know, I needed something like that. But, man, I've been watching that more and more the past couple months about that good life, taking good folks out, because they got a new primary purpose. Normal living is not the treatment for alcoholism. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only answer for people like me. If there was another answer, we'd be holed up over there tonight. Believe me, because this is the room where we have been looking our entire life for some relief, you know? And if you knew, I know there's something about you. I know there's something about you that you won't let anybody in on. I know there's some things that have happened to you in your life, and you have spent your entire life trying to get rid of the past. If I could just get rid of the past and these memories and stuff. And I'm here to tell you, if you're new, you no longer have to do that. You no longer got to get rid of that past. Because what you'll find in Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting in these meetings, that your past is your greatest asset. Now, how can all that garbage and that filth and that corruption, how could that be my greatest asset? It's because of what Alcoholics Anonymous is. One alcoholic talking to another. And it's not just about drunkalogs. It's the miracle of identification. When you finally get next to that person that you heard share in that meeting and you say, man, I've been going through that my entire life. This is what happened to me as a kid and stuff like that. And man, finally, somebody else understands. You understand. You understood me. You didn't talk down to me. You didn't beat me into submission. You related to me. And you not only related to me, you also told me, and this is what we're going to do about it. See, because that's the easiest thing for me to do to this day, is to take that old memories and all those guilts and remorses and just beat myself into submission, into uselessness every day, hounding myself with that past. And I tell you, there's a place for your past, and it's right there up on the shelf. And you don't need to take it down to beat yourself up every day. There's only one time you should take that down. For me, it's when that new man's sitting next to me and he's saying something that I did. Then I've got a usefulness for it. What the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And thank God for you folks taking time with me. You know, I come from good people. I was born in Detroit, and I come out to California when I was about 5, 6 years old, you know, and my mom and dad were hardworking people. They worked 2 jobs, you know, and all kinds of stuff, you know, and my mom was a little Scandinavian lady. They had some problems. They got a divorce and some lot of violence in there, and they stuck me in a foster home and then an orphanage for a while, and then about 4 or 5 years later, they came out there and they got me again, and, you know, we tried to be together again. And my mom was a great lady. My mom was a little Scandinavian lady, and boy, she loved diet pills. She would love Palmdale. I mean, she loved to eat that speed and run around the house all day and night, you know, and sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage all night, you know, or raking the neighbor's yard around 3 in the morning, you know, just a busy lady, you know. And no matter what time you got up, she was up doing shit, you know. She was painting, picking her face for sure, you know, and just always busy. And one of her hobbies was to eat that speed and make these jigsaw puzzles, right? And huge jigsaw puzzles, you know, not the 2,000 piecers or the 8,000 piecers, right? The 1 million piecers, right, of the Mojave Desert. You know, this would excite her. Oh, it's going to be a beige night tonight, honey, you know, and she'd get all excited, you know, and run down to that drugstore, and she smoked these god-awful Raleigh cigarettes, man. You might have been smoking Bugler, for God's sakes, you know. And the thing that she liked about these cigarettes is that on the back of each pack of cigarettes was a coupon, and there was a catalog, and if you save enough coupons, you could buy stuff. And she would buy more puzzles and stuff like that with it, man. And she loved it, man. And she had a little routine. And She'd get that stinky peroxide on her hair and run down to the drugstore and get her prescription filled and get her another puzzle, you know, and she'd squeeze into that little breakfast nook, you know, and start making this puzzle and, you know, smoking those Raleighs. And if she got a piece of puzzle that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers and she just snipped that son of a gun and wedge it right in there, man. There was no stopping Betty, man, let me tell you, man. Oh, yeah. She loved a needlepoint, you know. Everything in the house had fresh afghans on it all the time, man. Chairs had afghans. Couches had afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads she knit in there, you know. If there was any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And we didn't have a big house, but she had this one little room, you know, about the size of a restroom, you know, and that's where she would do all of her knitting. And you could hear her all night just going to town, man, you know. I loved her to death, man. Loved my mom to death. And looking back, she kind of looked like that old actress Kim Novak. Just a beautiful lady, man. And Betty had friends, and Betty was sociable, and Betty was well-liked, and everybody liked being around Betty, man. She was, you know, just a little ray of sunshine. And I never want to forget when I was 17 years old, coming back out of jail one more time, that bus drops me off, and I'm supposed to run into the courthouse and talk to the probation department and stuff, and the bus lets me off on a Monday, and I'm supposed to run over there to the courthouse. But I get off that bus on that Monday morning, and I run back to Gardena, where I'm going to die. And 4 days later, on a Thursday morning, it's 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm at the parking lot of my mom's place of business. She's cleaning people's homes, and she's works at a dry cleaner's. 8 o'clock in the morning with the rain hitting me. I'm standing in this parking lot. She's about from here to that wall. I'm hiding behind a parked car, waiting for that last customer to come out of that dry cleaner so I can make the move. And that rain's hitting me, man, just like it was yesterday. I start walking through that parking lot. And I look at my filth and my disgust and the blood and the needle marks and what Wino Joe used to call the habiliments of despair. Walking up to that lady with one thought, not how she's doing. She better have a buck. And I open up that glass door and that brass bell hits that window and my mom turns around and makes that oh so familiar sound. Oh my God, where have you been? And then she goes to her wallet and she peels off one and two and $3, you know. And then there's a picture of me that falls out of the wallet. I'm 8 years old and I'm on a Little League team. Which would be the only picture she would have until I meet you guys. And I see that money that she's peeling off and I run by that lady and I grab that money and I run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Never want to forget that. My drinking ain't bothering anybody. Never want to forget that. And that lady was to suffer and suffer and suffer from that point on. As those and those all around me. Now my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. He was a refinery worker. And so he was always coming home at different hours. And My dad was a window climber. My dad was a drunken, he was a window climbing alky, which I believe is a lost art in Alcoholics Anonymous. That old boy standing on that gas meter all night, pounding on that window, hoping that it's his own home, getting ready to make that magic dive over that toilet, over that sink, man. And I remember Dad sneaking in my window one night, and that old refinery boot came down on my chest. I grabbed that boot, and I said, "Gee, Pop," I said, "you know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys? You know, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know, and then, you know, she's up anyway, you know. She'd probably make it with her little teeth, you know." And my dad made drinking look good. His drinking didn't scare me. You know, he changed his tune and was singing and, oh, yeah, you know. But I tell you, as time went on, I began to run away from home because I didn't understand the violence in the house. And I didn't know what was going on there. All I know is I felt more a part of the streets at midnight than I did around my own dinner table with these folks. And I couldn't understand that, you know. And what I carried with me most of my childhood wasn't so much fear, it was guilt. How come I can't stop him from doing that? How come I can't stop that? Why, what, you know, and I felt so weak that I couldn't stand myself. And I started running away from there and, you know, I become a window climber just like my dad, you know. He's coming in and I'm going out, you know. You know, and me and my dad began to separate our little ways from then, you know. And that's why it's so important. They would tell me what to do, but they wouldn't do it themselves. And that's why in Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys spoke volumes to me when you not only would give me direction, I could see you doing it in your own homes. You see what I mean if you're new? Alcoholics Anonymous isn't just for an hour and a half. Alcoholics Anonymous starts when you leave. What do you like at home? What do you like at work? What do you like in the neighborhood? What do you like in the store? That's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And, yeah, you know, my dad made drinking look good, and I remember being 11 years old, and there's about four of us in a garage across the street, and me and my little buddy Louis Sanchez, and he got a bottle of Four Rose whiskey, and me and about six other guys were in there, and we start drinking, and man, I never threw up so much my entire life, man. I mean, I had Gerbers all over the place, man, you know? And but we finally got it down, man, and I had some of that Four Rose whiskey and never laughed so hard in all my life, man, you know. And that evening, the magic happened to me at 11 years old. I kissed my first Latin woman, and it was my aunt. I went after my Auntie Della, made my uncle a little edgy, you know, and I counted it, you know, and... And I loved it, man. I loved it. And I remember coming home and following in the bushes and laughing with Louie and stuff like that and sneaking into that house and wondering if the old man was there and the car was gone. So I was able to go to my bedroom and finally went into my bedroom, man, and fell on that bed. And the bed took off like a flying saucer, man. Started spinning around, man. And I woke up the next morning scared to death because I thought he was home. And I came out of the hallway and I looked both ways to see if the old man was there, and he wasn't around, the car wasn't there, so I went across the hall to his little private room, and my dad had made his own bar, beautiful bar, you know, and it wasn't like we're used to where they can line up 15 people, you know what I mean, it was an alky bar, it fit one guy, you know what I mean, had his little pickled pig feet up there, you know what I mean? And, you know, one guy, man. And I went in there, you know, to get a shot of some of that Thunderbird wine. And he had a lock on that thing about the size of a big book, you know. He knew who was down the hall, you know what I mean? And man, we started our separate ways, you know. And I didn't head out to Skid Row that next day at 11 years old and lose my paper route and come to AA or anything like that. But I tell you what, I started thinking about that night before. I started thinking about where you took me. I started thinking about the place you took me to with that bottle. Now, I've always known I was been a nobody. I've been hearing that my entire life up to that point. And I tell you what happened to me that evening is this little nobody felt like somebody for 5 hours. And I knew what did it. It was that Four Rose whiskey. It wasn't education. It wasn't living a good life. It was that Four Rose whiskey. And I become preoccupied with doing it again. And at 11 years old, I wasn't beaten on the bar or nothing like that. But the older I got, the more preoccupied I couldn't wait to do it again. And at 12 years old, me and my little buddy Johnny Johnson are watching this guy's car. He's a friend of my sister's, and he's got a 57 Chevy Nomad. It's a beaut, and he wants us to wash it and wax it And when we're done, while he's at work, he wants us to move it from the front yard into the garage. And he gave me the keys. Oh, yeah. Big Daddy at 12 years old, man. We washed that thing, and Johnny says, man, we got to dry it off. And I says, I know. And we got in there, man, and we drove it around to dry it off, right? We're drinking some of Johnny's dad's at Coors that they had back then, you know. And I'm in that little Nomad, and we hit that little dip in the street where the water is. And he says, put your foot on the brake and put your foot on the gas and slowly let it off, man. And that thing, it took me right into a parked car and then another parked car. And then I rolled for about 50 yards. But when it finally stopped, the cops were there and the lights were going. At 12 years old, I got my drunken driving. I wasn't going to drive unless somebody was over 21 with a license with me. And that's, you know, that made my dad a happy camper, you know what I mean? Like I said, I didn't head out the skid row, but I was preoccupied with it. I found my secret to life. This little loser found a companion, man, you know? The older I got, the more I did it. And by the time I, freshman in high school, kids are going to their locker rooms to, you know, get their books and their notebooks, and I'm going to my locker room to take a shot of some, you know, Four Rose whiskey or some Thunderbird, take some barbiturates, you know, and I started dating this little Mexican girl, and, you know, she had some brothers, and they liked cars, and I love cars to this day, you know, I had myself a nice 62 Chevy Impala, dropped right to the ground, had my hair all stacked up and combed back, and had my white t-shirts with my black khaki pants up to here, and Loopy, you know, her sister would curl her hair with soup cans, and the noodles were stuck in there, you know, and her sisters were telling me that men who are well endowed had big feet, so I went out and got me a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know, and I'm bouncing around with my big hair and my big feet, you know. Alan tripped over my foot tonight, and I felt proud, you know. And, man, we drive around all day and night, you know, drinking that wine, listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye. And, God, I loved it, man. It wasn't too long ago I was in my plumbing truck and the Four Tops came on. I just started sinking in my damn car. I loved it, man. And I thought for sure me and Pooch and Loopy were going to bounce off into the sunset forever, man. We found our life, man, and I remember one weekend, we were drinking that 151 rum. Oh, baby. Started at 10 o'clock in the morning. Somewhere around 1 o'clock, Loopy says, hey, why don't... She goes, drive into the Jack in the Box. And let's go talk to the puppet, you know. We were a lonely couple, all right? You know what I mean? So, man, I'm blitzed. I see about 10 puppets when I'm rolling in there, you know, and I'm wondering which one's the real one, but they're all yelling at me. Can I have your order, please, man? And I'm hoping I can hit the right one. And hit him, I did. I ran right over the puppet, man. It's hanging down like that. The cops come. They throw me on the hood, shatter my hair all over the place, you know. I don't drive till I'm 31. No big deal, man. You guys know there is nothing like riding shotgun. There is nothing like riding shotgun over there on the passenger side, drinking that Thunderbird, looking at yourself in that mirror, realizing what a good-looking man you are, for God's sake. You ought to be an underwear model. You know, you don't wear any, but what the hell, man? Take another shot, you take another look in that mirror, and you see that your hair is flat and straight up. You've been sleeping on the window all afternoon. You got cigarette butts stuck in there. You got tamale puke on your chest, and you feel like dancing, you know? And, man, I loved it. I loved it, and I knew we were going to bounce off into the sunset forever. And around 1969, folks were going to different places, and I thought, well, you know what, man? I'm gonna grab my buddy, my dope dealer, and we're going to go to Detroit. I'm going to show him my roots. And so me and my buddy, man, we started bouncing off, and we're on our way to Detroit. Going to show them 8 Mile and Pontiac, Michigan and everything, right? And we head out, man, and we wound up in Phoenix. Over off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel, right? five floors. Everybody's got a bathroom. It's down the hall. Everybody's got a TV. It's in the lobby. You know, all that's in a room is a bed and a little window. I'm afraid to leave that place during the day. I'm afraid to be by myself at night, you know. And, you know, you go down to the lobby down there and, you know, go across the street and two blocks down, you find yourself your watering hole. You got to find your watering hole, man. And I found the Wagon Wheel Inn. Beautiful place, man. No windows. Just a dirty curtain blowing through the door. It's got holes in it, you know. And I go into the Wagon Wheel and I meet this guy named Ernie. Every bar has an Ernie. Every bar. He's the answer man. I don't care what your problem is. Ernie's got the answer. And it's usually in his trunk, you know. You need an arm. You need a pet. You know. Everything's in the trunk. And I says, I need a job. And he says, well, come back in the morning. I'll put you to work. And I show up that morning, and Ernie hooks me up with a plumber. Now, I've never plumbed a thing in my life. The closest thing to plumbing that I've ever done was throw up in a toilet. That's about it, man, you know. And he introduces me to this plumber, and he's going to take me out to Tempe, Arizona, and he's going to... Now, I tell you, if there's anything that I love up to this point is being in a strange home. I love it. I love the possibilities. I love the things you can find, things stashed in the medicine chest, and the you know, it's just a swap meet of beauty for me. You know? And he takes me out there, you know, and sticks me underneath this house, and he says, "All I want you to do, kid, is hang copper. That's all I want you to do." Now, I've never done this stuff before, so you know, I've got my transistor radio. And I've got a pint of, you know, some Four Rows with some PM bourbon I had under there. And I'm underneath this house, and I'm kind of excited. And he sticks his head, and he goes, "All right, you go ahead and start hanging that copper. I'll be right back in about 8 or 9 hours to see how you're doing." "All right, sir." And, you know, and I'm underneath this house, and I'm excited. Oh, man, the things that I'm going to find down here, you know, just unbelievable, man. And I start crawling around, you know, and I'm not crawling around for more than, 5 or 10 minutes. And I look over there and, oh, my God, look at that. Oh, my God, and it's a stray cat. I'm, oh, my God, this is beautiful. I've never had this before, man. I've got a transistor, I got a pint, I got a pet. You know, I'm thinking, you know, this is the closest to normal living I've ever had up to this point, man. And I'm all excited, you know, and I start drinking that old hot bourbon, you know, to clear those pipes down because I'm going to start doing some plumbing, you know, and I keep hanging popper and I keep pushing that thing back. And after about a half hour, I bust up through that lady's floor and I rob her of all of her jewelry, you know, keep drinking that stuff. And yeah, I couldn't believe it. And after about 9 hours, pass out, and you know, the boss comes back and he drags me out from underneath the house, you know, and this cat comes running out with a bunch of necklaces on, you know, and stick me in jail for 6 months. And I got out of that jail, and in 1973 came back to Los Angeles, and my probation officer gives me antabuse. And there's no talk of AA, counseling, or nothing. He gives me this antabuse. And at this time in my life, people are saying stuff like, you know, "What do you want to be when you grow up? You know, what do you want to do with your life? You know, you have any idea, you know?" And I tell you, I was in a boarding house. And it was a hallway with 5 rooms on each side. And in each room was a single bed and a sink and a window. And every now and then I would get toasted on that wine, and I would look out that window, and I would look across the street at the Roy Tan Hotel, and there was this sign that said, "Rooms for rent with hot plates." And I thought to myself, one of these days I'm going to have that. One of these days my life is going to be together and I'll be able to have that. That's what my goal was then. And he's got me on this antabuse, and after about 90 days, he gives me a job interview, my probation officer, for a refinery out in El Segundo to be a part-time janitor at midnight. And so I'm going to be taking the bus. I'm going to be taking the bus for a long time until I'm 32. And, you know, when you take a bus, there's none of this, I'll be right there. You know, it's 3 or 4 hours, you know. And I get to this little town in El Segundo. I'd never been there before. And I got about 4 hours till my interview. And I'm in this little park. And kids are playing baseball and stuff like that. And I'm in the dugout. And, man, I start crying like a baby. I start thinking about Mom and Dad. And I can't believe that I'm crying. What's going on with me? And this would go on. Then I start laughing like a clown. And this would go on like that for a couple hours. I became so paranoid, like it was when I was DTing, and the hallucinations would come and go. Now they're sticking. Somebody sees me walking around, and they call the paramedics, and the paramedics surround me, and they come and get me and take me to the Harbor General Hospital in 1973. I'm over there on a gurney with an arm and a leg strapped down. And the doctor comes by my bed and he says, "Son, seems to be by the way you've been living that we need to put you away to be observed for a month or two to see what we're going to do with you." And so they sent me over the hill to this little mental facility, and a year later they let me out. And they observed me for a year, and they didn't know what the hell was wrong with me, you know. They gave me medication to take, and after they let me know, about 2 months later, I'm in downtown Los Angeles, over there off of Skid Row by Alvaro Street, across the street at a Chevron gas station. I'm over there on a pile of tires. You see, because at 1975, at this time in my life, I'm going back and forth from Long Beach to L.A., along Alameda and Western, so I don't go crazy. And at this time in my life, there is no invisible line of what a person does or doesn't do for a shot of alcohol. And they find me over there on a pile of tires over there, and they arrest me for a public nuisance, public drunk, violation of probation, out-of-state forgeries. And it seemed to me that I've been writing forgeries for barbiturates. I faked a knee injury over in Phoenix, you know, and the doctor gave me some Percodan, and then when he left the office, there was a cardboard box of blank prescription pads that I thought he left for me. Took those things running down North Central, man. And so they sent me to 2.5 years in the state penitentiary, and they sent me up to Wayside. And I'm up at Wayside, early of 75, and after about 2 months, they get a black and white bus, and they get about 50 of us, and they load us in that bus, and they take us to, I'm ready for, it takes me for a 15-minute car ride to the jailhouse, and I'm in a holding tank about the size of this room. And one by one, the judge starts calling these guys out, and they're not coming back. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the only one left. I'm on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering where they're going to send me now, because they're always sending me somewhere. You see, from the time I was 13 to the time I was 30, there's always been somebody taking me somewhere, because that was the cure. Whether they be from the medicine, or whether they be from religion, or they be self-help, or a church, everybody was all trying to do the same thing. Separate me from alcohol. If we just separate him from alcohol, everything will be all right. But not so with the alcoholic of my type. When you have an alcoholic of my type, sobriety drives you to drink time and time and time again, because you keep returning to the life that's killing you. And you have no way out. And the longer you stay, I don't care how desperate you are, desperation will wear off. And if you can't replace desperation with inspiration, you're a dead man. It's not because you're an alcoholic. It's not because you have a disease. It's not because you have alcoholism. You are in the grips of a progressive illness. Get it? It has you. And will always have you. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for folks like me through folks like you has loosened up that grip just enough to put that book into my life. And after that desperation, I was inspired to do something for the first time in my life. Nothing happened to me suddenly. It happened to me gradually, thank God. And it happened after I took certain actions. And I've become inspired to do something for the first time in my life, man. And they took me to that little jail. And man, I'm the only one there. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm wondering where they're going to send me now, man. They're sending me somewhere. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I heard the most beautiful sound a guy like me can hear. It's the sound of jailer's keys coming down the hallway. And man, there's a sheriff. And he opens up that lime green door, slides that jail door open. And in 1975, there's a Scottish man with a patch standing there. And he looks through there and he goes, "Aye, lad." He goes, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." "Ah, that's great. That's great." He says, "Come with me, son. We're going to AA." And I thought, AA? What's AA? I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA? And who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? Where's your parrot, you know? "Aye, lad," you know? And looking back, well over 40 years, I know exactly what he is because I'm staring at him. I'm staring at him. He's what that book calls, if you read it, a trusted servant. Now, what made that man a trusted servant was simply this. He had no business being there. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a probation officer. He wasn't part of H&I. He was a refinery worker who just got the worst news of his life. His little wife was dying immediately of a terminal illness. He knew that she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. And he was driving around, and he turned his little car around, and he went to the South Bay Courthouse, talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they said, "We got a guy for you." And the man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. Beautiful little car. I was ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch. He takes me through a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rolls up to this dingy, stinking, rotten, filthy Torrance Lamita Alano Club. You know, I mean, what kind of word is Alano anyway? What is an Alano? You know, is it like an elk or a moose? Watch for crossing Alanos or something, right? He rolled up to this Alano, and there's all the Alanos walking around, man. Everybody had a nickname and a tattoo. He starts introducing me to all these goofy people, Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam, Serenity Sam, Bicycle Ray, Santa Claus Ray, Dancing Pete, Whistling Butt, all these people, man. I just left a group of people like this, right? Little Moose was 120 years old. She comes running after me. She goes, "Hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are, honey. I'm not it, you know." Then this big transvestite starts circling me like a helicopter in Long Beach, you know. And he finally lands and comes walking over to me in his new moo-moo, and he says, "Hi." He says, "I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting." I says, "I don't think so, big guy, you know. You know, not till I get my year, you know." And I said, "My God, if that's AA, I don't want any part of this, man, you know. And after the effect of that big book, I'm not going to crack that thing open either, man." And I tell you, I was to hop on the road to hell ever since that day. Because from 1975 to 1982, is I came in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not at AA. I came out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, where they were in Manhattan, Redondo, Torrance, no matter where it was. I did what I've been doing since I was 13. I sat in that chair waiting for you to do something for me. I've had my hand out my entire life. I'm a something-for-nothing guy. Give me that sobriety. I'll do this stuff later. Right? Playing off people's affections. one more time, promising mom, yeah, this is it, mom, I'm back in AA, just to see me drunk and arrested 3 weeks later. Building them up and tearing them down. That's the only steady thing in my life. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, you people would come and get me. And you never said, are you ready yet? Or you've been here before? You never said that. You should get in the car. And most of the time, it was this little Montana cowboy named Don. And on May 2nd, 1982, I'm down in Wilmington at the Beacon Light Mission. And the mission is they take you in at 6 at night, and you sing for your beans, and you get saved, and then they let you out early in the morning for you to go look for work or something like that. And man, they let me out, and I'm over there on the alley, like we are, sitting on that curb, got a little towel or a rug wrapped around me, and the thought came to me, and I came to believe. No. I didn't come to believe in God. I didn't come to believe in AA. I came to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of me running my life any longer. That at 30 years old, I'd given it my best shot. And I did the hardest thing that an alcoholic could do. Surrender. I'm going to ask for help. And I know who to call. I'm going to call up that Montana cowboy. So I panhandled some money, walked over to the 76 station, called the Alano Club, and who do I get? I get Don. Don, this is Larry. I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty rear down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. And man, was I fired up. Did you hang up on me? Oh, man. And I walked 10 miles with my poopy pants and no hope from Wilmington to Torrance to that Alano Club to do one thing, to get in that guy's face and tell him, you don't hang up on me. It took me 2 weeks to get there. And I got there, man. And man, I tell you, I hadn't drank for about a day, so I was rolling, baby. I was ready to shake, and man, they didn't run me to a detox. They didn't run me to the urgent care. Frank and Lucille from Texas started walking me. They kept walking me and giving me honey and orange juice, buttermilk. Whose idea was that, you know? And when I would shake and flop down on the ground, they would hold me and they would hug me. What are you doing here? And I says, I got to talk to Don. Well, he'll be here at 1 o'clock. And they walked me and stuck with me. And at 1 o'clock, that old Montana cowboy pulled up with his El Camino truck full of lumber. And he walked into that club like he owns it. And I'm over there, and I'm going to light him up. Hitched up my poopy pants and started walking towards him. And I got right up to his face, and he says, how you doing, kid? And I said, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? Where the hell did that come from? You know? He says, on one condition, hotshot, you make the effort, I'll make the effort. If you don't make the effort, Larry, lose my number. I got guys that want to do this thing. And I fell in love with that guy. I fell in love with him. No, everything wasn't comfortable from that point on. No, it wasn't easy to do. But the thought came to me, I'm not going to let anybody run me out of Alcoholics Anonymous again, especially me. You guys say that seeing is believing. What do you do if you don't believe? What do you do if you can't believe? What do you do if you have no conception of a God because of what happened at 5 years old that you didn't want nothing to do with? How do you come to it? And when I got to here, you guys were telling me not to worry about it. Don't worry about it. It'll happen. Well, I tell you, it took me 7 or 8 years, but it finally came to me that when I walked into that home group, I could realize that if I looked over my shoulder, I could see from day one to right now that Alcoholics Anonymous has taken care of me. Isn't that what the third step says? We turned our life and our will over to the care of God. And nobody has taken better care of me than the people of Alcoholics Anonymous and the meetings. And I started right there because I'm a stickler for evidence. And nothing is more evident to me tonight and every time I'm with you of the power of Alcoholics. See, I'm not educated, so I don't know how to separate AA from God. To me, there's the same thing, and I can't think about one without thinking about the other. But I'll tell you this if you're new. On a Friday night, out here in Palmdale or Lancaster or Timbuktu, wherever we're at, tonight I'm witnessing a man take a cake. I'm witnessing new people come in, and I see row after row after row of people who should be dead, locked up, or insane. And look at us tonight. We've been playing in the evidence. Come on back. Let's do it again. Thank you.